Hi, this is Chris, producer of the Lion City Rock podcast. And first up, I just want to apologize very quickly for the sound of my voice in the rest of this podcast. Basically, I had a very bad throat, and so you're going to hear me speaking with quite a bit of vocal fry throughout the entire session. But that doesn't mean that the podcast is going to be any less good, because we have a very cool guest this week. So without much further ado, let's just bring it on to the pod. Lion City Rock, here we go.
3, 2, 1. Hello and welcome to another episode of Lion City Rock, the only podcast about Singapore's pop music scene that you're ever going to need, right, Kevin?
It's all you need. It's all you need, yes. Except no substitutes, yeah.
No substitutes. That's right, that's right. Yeah, man, I also see. If this is the first time that you guys are joining us, welcome. We hope you like it. We'll just do a bit of housekeeping and tell everybody here to share this podcast with people that you know, people that you like, people that you don't like also, never mind.
Yeah, especially them.
Especially the people that you don't like.
Okay. Yeah. Punish them, yeah.
Punish them. Yeah. That's true. I just wanna do a quick little update and stuff like that. Regarding, you know, the pod and stuff like that. Firstly, I wanna thank everybody who's been like chiming in and commenting about our podcast over the past few months. Sorry you haven't gotten to this earlier, but for things like our Yubing's interview, as well as our bit on the Padres, where we got quite a lot of feedback from that one. People talking about Joe Ng and the Padres, you know. I mean, I never expected, frankly, anybody to actually respond to any of those things. But
don't underestimate nostalgia.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, there's a comment here by Kelvin, and he said like, "Oh, these are legends." I said, but actually, the people who actually listen to this podcast and actually take time out to key in their few comments, you guys are actually the legends, lah. And we're just helping to, you know, be the vessel for the the sound that is coming out from the Lion City. We've also crossed our 6,200 download mark.
Oh, so right.
Cool. Thanks to you guys again, and also from people from around the world. You know, from the UK, from the US. We've had a few interesting places pop up in our we have that chart where they show you where who's listening to what from
where,
that kind of stuff, right? So over the last 3 months, like for this year anyway, we had people from the United States, Malaysia, Hong Kong, UK, Spain, Cambodia, this one was interesting, Romania, Thailand, Mexico, Turkey, Germany, Belgium, and China. So thanks, you guys from all over the world tuning in.
Yeah, thank you.
And listening to us ramble about music from here. We hope you like it, and we hope that you guys actually go out and like go check out more of these kind of things. You know, there's you can get a lot of the new music on Spotify. You can get a lot of the
lots of things
on YouTube.
Lots of things happening.
So we hope that you guys are enjoying this, you know, because the, you know, Singapore, as we've always tried to say, is, you know, it's not short on talent, lah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and speaking of talent, today we have a very special guest coming on. He's written a book about making rock music and urban life in Singapore. The book is called Sonic City. This was written a few years ago, but we'll get him on to discuss a little bit more about this. So please put your hands together and welcome Steve Frazaka.
Woohoo! Yay!
Insert crowd noise here. Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good. How are you? It's a pleasure to be with you guys.
I understand. I mean, you're in Singapore now, but you don't live here, right? Do you?
That's correct. I live in Canada, Alberta, Canada. So now you can add Canada to your list.
Right. Okay, cool. I mean, you know, you're here in Singapore now, ostensibly to be the MC of a special gig that's happening this weekend. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
This weekend at the Blackbird, there'll be a tribute concert to the late and great Jimmy Apadurai Chua, who's a legendary guitarist in the Singapore scene beginning in the 60s. And he continued to play all throughout his life. He just recently passed. Yep. So the program is a collection of some of the musicians from that time period, and especially those that knew Jimmy. And we're going to perform a tribute show and let them know that we're still thinking of them all the time.
And, you know, like this show is at Blackbird. Well, actually, by the time you hear this, the show will probably have gone. How was it? Was it a good gig?
It's hard. I think it'll be a good gig.
Yeah. I mean, I'm actually quite looking forward to going for that. Because not only is it like a tribute to Jimmy, who's you're always very, very forthcoming with you know, everything, basically. You know, when you talk to him, you know, you ask him for help and stuff like that. He's always, you know, if he can, he will just, like, you know, offer his help in any way or whatever last time.
Yeah. He was always wonderful to work with. We got to play together several times. I met him early on here in Singapore when I started my appointment at the Asia Research Institute at NUS, and he's always been a big supporter and encouraged me with the book, and is also continuing with playing music with the guys. So he accommodated people, he encouraged people, and he was a true force.
I mean, in your book, you mentioned about how you first came to Singapore and started getting into or finding out about the local music scene here. But maybe for yourself, like, were you always very interested in music? Was it something that you kind of liked to do or listen to when you were young?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I think Jimmy picked up the guitar when he was 14. I think I picked up the guitar when I was 14. Wow. But in different places, right? Yet we listening to a lot of the same music. So that's what's really kind of fascinating about this is that, you know, we're the same age and grew up in a particular time in world history, but in two totally different places with totally different things happening.
Can you also, like, talk a bit about how you first came to know about the Singapore music scene? You mentioned that you were working at the Asia Institute here in NUS. So how did that work out? Like, you came here to do work at NUS, and then you end up hooking up with, like, all the guys from the music scene here.
Yeah, it took me by surprise too. I arrived, you know, to take up this appointment at the Research Institute, and for most of my career, I'm an anthropologist. I just recently retired. I'm a cultural anthropologist, and for most of my career, I studied medicine in Indonesia in an urban kampung, and that's what I was most well known for. And I came to the Research Institute to write up some more of that data. However, I was jet lagged and when I first arrived, and this was 2011. And I, you know, I got online and I looked for the guitar shops, and because it's been a part of my life, not centrally always, kind of comes in and out. And so I went down to the guitar shops in the Peninsula Shopping Center, and I was totally blown away. I did not expect to see what I saw. I mean, first of all, the number of guitar shops all clustered together, but then the incredible collection of instruments, both new and used and vintage. I mean, I could spend hours there just looking through all of the shops. I really fell in love with a Guitar Connection because of all their vintage instruments, stuff you don't see anywhere. So I was hanging out down there in the basement and of the shopping mall, and I encountered Guitar 77. And behind the counter was an older gentleman like myself, Lim Pyong. And I had seen the guitar in the window of the guitar shop, and I asked him if I could play it.
Right.
He said, sure. And he gave it to me, and he plugged me into an amplifier, and I started playing blues music. And he kind of yelled out from behind the counter, "You're a blues man." I said, "Well, I don't know." Anyway, he got out from behind the counter and grabbed a bass guitar and plugged it in, and we started playing together. And we played Stormy Monday.
Wow.
Classic blues song. And by the time when we finished, we both looked at each other and we said, you know what, you know, and I know we could play together. And so that kind of started it. And we would play in the shop, you know, around happy hour, usually on weekends, but sometimes during the weekdays. And then Keon introduced me to James Tan. And I found out that they were both original members of this 1960s legendary English language rock band, the Stray Dogs. And that, of course, totally piqued my interest. and the three of us started playing together, and we decided to form a band. And we recruited a kind of gunslinger, young gun guitarist, Victor Chen. And we started playing mostly blues classics, and all in the shop at the time, but they were kind of like rehearsals. And people would, especially on Saturdays, we would draw quite a crowd. 'Cause one, you could hear the music throughout the basement.
Yeah.
And two, some people heard that you could go down to Guitar 77 and hear these guys play. So that's kind of how it all got started. And then we decided, hey, you know, let's take this out, you know, live somewhere and see how it goes. But that's how it got going. And it distracted my attention at the Research Institute from my Indonesian stuff. Because I was realizing I was seeing a kind of side of Singapore that not many people might see, especially foreigners like me, you know, Ang Mo from somewhere else, and expats and that kind of thing. And so I went back to my cluster leader back at the Research Institute, and I said, you know, I'm hearing some really great stories and having some very interesting experiences down in this guitar shop. I think I want to do a project on it. And he agreed and encouraged me to go forward with it. And so that's kind of how it all, I continue to write up my Indonesian data, but then kind of began what I would call field work, you know, in Guitar 77 and with this community of musicians, friends, fans, and family. So that's how it got going.
Go down to Guitar 77.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
It's hardly work, is it?
Okay, so this is my take on it, right? So, yeah. I mean, on the face of it, it seems like it's a very academic look at Singapore, the urban landscape here in Singapore, the society, and the kind of very incongruously, in my opinion, like the music that's happening at Guitar 77 downstairs in the basement of Peninsula, and overall the general music vibe happening in conjunction with this economic development of this city or country.
Right.
So it comes across a bit like that, but it's also, a lot of it, I find it's a story of your own journey here through this musical landscape, and also the story of the Stray Dogs. because you do get really into it with
yeah
your...
yeah 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 no you picked up on it you got it that I mean I wanted you know I'm an academic and so and an anthropologist and I wanted to apply some of that perspective and approach and some of the theoretical orientations that come out of that discipline but it wasn't that kind of experience, really. It was a lived experience. And in this, like I said, this small community of musicians, multi-generational, but it included these guys from the 60s. And it was the journey, as you say, that I really wanted to capture rather than trying to come to any kind of deep analysis of Singaporean society. In fact, the book gets criticized by academics because I don't do the really deep analysis. Some of it is there, but I kind of go for the story. As an anthropologist and an ethnographer, I consider myself a storyteller, and I always have. And so I've always been a little less kind of analytical, so to speak, than some of my colleagues. And so I got some critiques for that, but that's okay.
Yeah. I think bottom line is always, it's always about telling stories, you know. I mean, sometimes the analysis or aspect of it can get a bit snooty and snobby and things like that, right? So I'd rather, you know, let's just tell stories. Let's be down to earth about these things.
Yeah, well, that's exactly where I was at with this book and where I'm at generally. I mean, I wanted to kind of tell a story about what was in front of me and what I was a part of, you know, not some model of gender relations or ethnic relations that I'm going to slap on top of the experiences that I was having. I mean, I saw some of those things and I talk about them in the book a bit, but rather than applying models from sociology and anthropology and then explaining using those models to explain what I was experiencing, that didn't make any sense to me, you know? And so it was the story that had to be told.
Yeah, I mean, okay, speaking about telling stories and stuff like that, you use this phrase inside this thing, which is like the most academic thing I've ever read in a book about Singapore music, sonic ethnography. What does that mean? Explain to us, blur people down here.
okay. Well, I mean, ethnography is the prime method of the anthropologist. And that's basically, we do field work, long-term field work. We learn the language. We use interviews of various kinds. But one of the main features of ethnography is what is referred to as participant observation. So we get involved, right? Mm. We get involved. But I found that notion of ethnography to be a little limiting because it set me up as the observer. And so if you remember in the book, I kind of moved from participant observation to what is known as participant experience. Mm. So instead of being kind of a fly on the wall, I try to let readers know what the experiences were like. So ethnography is a method. It's also a form of literature. So that book there would be called an ethnography. Sonic ethnography. Okay, well, I mean, I took kind of a two-angled approach on the sonic ethnography. First of all, kind of as an observer, participant observer, I could describe the soundscape. Okay. And if you remember in the beginning of the book, I kind of come up with this idea in Indonesia, actually, this notion of deep sound, where I described the soundscape, and then I realized as I was describing it that some of the sounds actually were social actors. You know, they were socially involved in the community. It just wasn't humans making the sound. The sound itself shaped social relations. For example, that sweeping of the broom in the afternoon that would call everyone else to come sweep up their street out in front of their house so people could congregate in the late afternoon as the heat died down and hang out together, you know. So when you heard that sound, you knew it was time, you know, right, to kind of get it together, you know. And so that was one way to approach sonic ethnography, was to describe soundscapes. But that notion of sound as having a social life and being socially involved in lives, that took me to the other aspect of sonic ethnography. And that was long-term field work. I've been working with these guys for, well, now over a decade, but officially with the book, it's, I think, about 6 or 7 years. Becoming a member or part of a community for which sound is a central feature of their life, you know, whether making it, listening to it, it's a feature of their social life. It has social action in their life. And so that's what I was going for with sonic ethnography, were those kind of two elements. One, just describing a soundscape, and then maybe doing some analysis of that. But two, becoming a member of a community who knows who their way in the world is through sound. And, you know, I got to tell you, with Keon and James and all the other guys and Jimmy, sound is central to how they live their lives.
Yep.
A band like, say, the Stray Dogs is often one of those things that's always overlooked by the media here. I mean, if you just ask the media, you know, what Singapore music was like in the 60s, they only come out with, like, at most three names. You know, you get the Quest, obviously. You get the Crescendos, because they kind of like kicked it off for everybody else. And if you're lucky, you get Naomi and the Boys. And then a lot of the bands that came out in the latter half of the 60s, like your Stray Dogs, October Cherries, and all those other guys, they tend to get lumped into this group of, oh, by the way, you know, you know what I mean?
Well, that's an interesting point you make. When we played the Esplanade, a buddy of mine, a geographer, was sitting in the audience, and a Singapore guy was sitting next to him. My buddy is from the States, so foreigner. He was teaching at NUS. Anyway, sitting in the audience, Singapore man sitting next to him. We start up, and the man turns to him and says, "These guys were the alternative." So, I mean, so for me, that's like fantastic data, right? But
yeah, I mean, it's an outlier. I mean, Stray Dogs definitely outliers. I mean, also significantly at that time in our history, you know, basically the government was beginning to be very reactionary against rock music. So you could say Stray Dogs represented that so-called menace to society that Dr. Goh spoke about, you know, a couple of years later.
Yeah, the Yellow Culture campaigns,
yep,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's so great about these guys and like this collection of musicians that are going to be there for Jimmy's show, that, you know, they had to get through all of this. The resilience there is unbelievably wonderful. And I've learned a lot from them about resilience, and have, you know, it's a great lesson.
Yeah. And that's a story that doesn't really get much exposure nowadays, right? It tends to get kind of swept under the carpet.
Or it gets cleansed, right?
Yes.
You know, in order to become some form of national heritage or something like that. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the paper written by Lily. Is it Lily Kong?
Yes.
You cited, and that was one of the first things that I ever read about that whole period, you know, the
70s
through the 80s, all the steps that were being taken to kind of like I guess, dumb down the scene in a way, lah.
Well, that paper was incredibly important to me and my thinking about all of this. In fact, if I had to cite one piece of work, it would be Lily's paper, that article. Yeah, it was very influential. It also gave me ways to think about heritage. So, yeah, wonderful paper.
How so?
Well, because she did note, as we were just saying, that, you know, in that exhibit at the museum or wherever it was at, I can't remember now, retrospective or something like that, that, you know, they, in that kind of milieu, in that context, the kind of alternative that the Singapore man said to my friend was being kind of, as you say, dumbed down or cleansed, right? In order to kind of meet the goals of, you know, national heritage and that kind of thing. But she talks about the convergence of different kinds of heritage. And that really struck me. And that's what I thought I was seeing at times when we played, when we rehearsed, and especially the Esplanade show. I mean, I was so lucky to be involved in that because it was such a wonderful example of the convergence of kind of vernacular heritage and national heritage all at once, kind of across different spaces of the stage and the dressing rooms and all those kinds of things. Yeah, I mean, that does, again, that paper kind of led this notion of convergence led me to kind of consider, well, what other kinds of heritage are involved here? What am I experiencing? What am I seeing? And of course, the vernacular heritage was Katong. These guys all grew up in Katong. Katong haunts every one of our rehearsals, every one of our gigs.
Really? Wow.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and right now, Ronnie and his brother Lenny are here from Australia. Ronnie was the harmonica player in the Stray Dogs, and we're seeing all their childhood friends, you know, having dinner and lunch and that kind of thing. And it's Katong, and it's, you know, so it in the Esplanade, it was funny because the producer was not quite sure about us because we were the alternative and he didn't know what we were going to do. He wasn't sure we could perform the set within the time limit. We had to submit the songs and the lyrics beforehand, and right. he kept coming back to the dressing room to see if we were drinking or something. And of course we were. So, I mean, he was a good guy, a really good guy. But I mean, he, as anybody who's producing a show, he was worried, you know, wanted it to come off well. And we were kind of a wild card, as the Stray Dogs historically have been kind of a wild card in Singapore's development towards modernity or whatever you want to say.
You guys also went to tour in Vietnam as well.
That's right.
Was that the only place you guys went to, or did you guys go to different
We went to Ho Chi Minh twice and Malacca.
Oh, okay.
One for show. Yeah. So that was our touring. I mean, the Ho Chi Minh thing was so interesting because, again, just like we started, you know, we were both, I was living in the States. I'm a dual citizen, U.S., Canadian. I was living in the States. It was the 1960s. I was in high school. I was deeply involved in protesting the American war in Vietnam.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and all that music was tied up with it. Yet here was Keong and the Stray Dogs and others listening to the same music, but because the war were providing them opportunities to play and nurture this music, it was a kind of different angle. And so when we went to Ho Chi Minh, that's what I noticed. We passed the old American embassy in Ho Chi Minh, where the helicopters were lifting people off the top, you know. that had a whole different meaning for me as we passed it than it. I don't think it meant anything to the other guys, you know, to Keong and James and the other guys. And we had we did a performance, and we had a late night dinner up on top of a rooftop of a building, and I was pinching myself. I mean, here's this place that had been so important to me growing up. I mean, it defined who I was. And I'm sitting here on top of this, on this rooftop eating dinner with these guys. And for them, it was an entirely different kind of narrative, you know? Yep. And so I found that, again, fascinating. Ho Chi Minh was eye-opening for me in that sense, that we were both global and local at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, maybe you could also talk, I mean, you do mention in your book a lot of these spots here in Singapore, like you mentioned, of course, Peninsula Shopping Centre is mentioned very early on, but you also you also spoke to people like Clement, who does Hood. Of course, the so-called doghouse sessions.
Yes.
down there. Can you talk a bit more about that vibe, that kind of thing? Because I think that's one thing that, I don't know about you, Kev, but like that whole idea of this small community almost exclusive community getting together. You know, could you talk a bit about your experiences with that? Because that was something that, you know, you kind of stumbled into, I gather, from the book. Yeah.
So, I mean, you just beautifully described it there, actually. Yeah, I stumbled into this. I mean, one thing that the community is exclusive, you're exactly right, which is why a lot of expats and, you know, foreign talent or whatever never sees these kinds of small pockets of communities around town. And, you know, my approach was just to keep showing up.
Okay.
You know, and that meant a lot, I think, to the people that I got to know. I think, you know, you're right. This town is a really tough town in terms of the music scene. Mm-hmm. You know, if I had to describe it in one word, it's capitalism. And, you know... And I mean, the rents are so high.
Yeah.
The food and F&B guys, you know, the food and beverage guys and the club owners and restauranters and stuff, you know, don't want to take any chances. So, you know, taking chances on these small communities compared to like a full blown cover band that can take requests from the audiences and that kind of stuff. You know, these communities can be found, but they're few and far between. Maybe they're more than I realize, but they're there. And in my opinion, it's in these communities that the kind of Singaporean or local creative forces and juices are really flowing. And it's because of what you described, the kind of reciprocity that's involved in these communities. We feed each other, we drink with each other, we play with each other, we help each other out. It's central. It's a different kind of economy compared to kind of capitalist, you know, market economy. It's based on, you know, I do something for you, you do something for me when you get a chance, that kind of thing, you know. And I try to describe that in the book. I thought that the cultural economy of these communities was counter to the overwrought capitalism that Singapore loves to celebrate.
Yeah, that's actually a very accurate and succinct description of, you know, the various the challenges that we have been facing for decades now, right? This kind of pushing against the capitalistic ideas, right, in favor of something that's a bit more artistic and cultural. But, you know, that's Singapore in a nutshell. Yeah.
And I'm not, I don't mean to criticize, you know, any of the bands that are out there, like at the Blackbird, we were there last night, any of the bands out there that are doing the cover music, because as far as I'm concerned, they're still localizing those global forces, you know, so it's not imitation or anything like that. You know, it's Singaporeans making some of this music that circulates globally their own, you know, I'm not criticizing it. It's, but they're different kind of animals, right?
And the
economies, just as you said, Kevin, are different, you know, and in the case of the community, it's a much more cultural kind of economy rather than profit oriented and getting paid and all that kind of stuff.
You know, I'm going to put you guys on the spot, right? So would it behoove these places? I mean, you have Blackbird, right? So in between when the guys are not playing on stage, they do all these piping music and stuff like that. How much trouble do you think it would be for them to just slot in, say, if they're playing a rock set, to slot in a Freedom or you know, a Stray Dogs track or an October Cherries track or something like that, or even like a Sam Willows or one of the more younger bands, just to put it into their thing? How much would that work to try to you know, instill a certain, oh, by the way, these are local guys and they're just as good as anything else you're going to hear tonight. What do you think?
Well, I know what I think. I think that sounds like a wonderful idea. And, you know, but again, there'll be some resistance to that. But I could see, you know, certain kinds of clubs or whatever. I mean, the Blackbird is hosting this tribute show. So at least they have some interest in the music heritage of the city state. But I think that would be, you know, could be somebody's, you know, particular club's approach, you know, or and that gets known, you know, you can go and not only hear the songs from the 70s and 80s and 90s that are covered, but hear other music, Singaporean music, some of it original, you know, that is part of our, the musical heritage here. So I don't know what you think, Kevin, but I mean, again, I think the club owners, you know, I watched Clement over the space of the two hoods, the one in Chinatown and one in Boogie's Plus. And it was clear to me that it's a rough business.
Yeah. I think for me personally, because I've been banging my head against the wall for so long, it's a bit of a... It's a bit of a lost cause as far as I'm concerned, the music scene, for me personally, you know. So so right now, in terms of this idea that, you know, Chris kind of talked about, I mean, it's something we've been talking about decades. 10 years ago, I was a council member in SG Mizo, and we were trying to push a quota, right, on all the local radio stations to play a certain percentage of local music, which is obviously something that was done in Canada years ago.
Yeah, that's right.
And help the Canadian artists to, you know, thrive, right? Because in the face of the American challenge, especially at that time, most of the Canadian artists like your Neil Young and your Joni Mitchells were all kind of going to the US. So I think in Canada, they was like saying, no, we can't keep having this brain drain, so to speak, right? So it has worked, right? In places like that, like Canada. But you know, it's just like, as you say, like, there'll always be resistance, so they'll just come up with the usual excuses, right? So to me, I'm not really thinking about in that space anymore. I kind of moved on from that.
Well, I totally understand that. I mean, it's like I said, it's a hard scene here, and if you're going to write original music, boy, I don't know, you know, I don't know where that, you know, I mean, they're General Lee, they were writing original music about kind of historical events in Singapore and stuff. I don't know if they're still together or not and playing publicly, but doing original music or even doing those songs from way back when, it would be tough to find a venue and a consistent one or with any kind of consistency, right? Maybe a one-off here or there.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's funny. The Canadian content thing is actually still kind of in play, but not like it was back in the day that you're describing. when the radio stations were forced to play a certain quota percentage of Canadian artists. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, well, I know that you'll be busy prepping for tomorrow, Steve, so I don't want to take up too much of your time. But I just a very quick thing, like, you know, in terms of this book, it came out...
right in the pandemic, 2020.
Yeah, 2021. Yeah, but you had actually done all the research and all that, like, years before 2021, right? So...
That's correct. The research started in 2011, went to 2016, and then, so remember, I talk in academic years, so so 2016, 2017, I was the head of study for the anthropology program at Yale and US, and that's when I sat down and really started writing the book. In fact, I got it done that year. And then turned it in to NUS Press. I didn't want to turn it into any. I didn't want to submit it to anybody else. I wanted it to come out on NUS, and be available here locally rather than, you know, on another academic press that might be hard to for people here to find.
Yeah. So So Sonic City: Making Rock Music and Urban Life in Singapore. The reason why I wanted to talk to you about this also because, to me, there's very few records of Singapore music as a book. Like you mentioned, Joe, who ostensibly did three books, I think.
Yeah,
one
right.
On the Golden Venus, and the other two are more like directories of bands and stuff like that.
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, that's why I read them too. But yeah. He's a journalist. Remember, he's a journalist. So
correct. I mean, in terms of books, there's hardly any others. I mean, Henry Chua of The Quest did one called College Anti, but that was like a memoir for him. And the only other one was, I guess, Andy's book, right? Kevin, Andy Chen's
No
Final Time to Be Alive. Yeah, but there's hardly any other... I can't really, or maybe I don't know. If you do know, you could recommend us what other books you should be reading.
You're right. You're right. And it's kind of like the original music issue, in a capitalist music soundscape. To write about music as an academic is not seen as serious.
Right.
You know? And so if you're going to propose to, if you're a local, if you're an academic here at the universities, NTU, NUS, whatever, and you're going to say, oh, I'm going to write books about the music scene in Singapore, you will not get the same kind of credit, you know, than writing about gender and power and race and all of that kind of stuff, you know, history, you know, of Christianity or whatever in Singapore. It doesn't have the same kind of value. So you're taking a chance, like the club owners who, you know, hire a local band like the Stray Dogs compared to the cover band. As an academic, you're taking a bit of a chance. If you notice, my book is not located in the library in anthropology, you know, and some of that was the way that NUS Press decided to categorize it. So they didn't even necessarily see it as a kind of traditional, conventional academic book, and therefore making sure that my library number would be located in anthropology. I don't care, but you know, that's the way it worked out.
Well, you know, good luck for the gig tomorrow.
Thank you.
I will try to pop down for as long as I can, because it'll run the gamut. I mean, it starts at 3 and it's gonna run all the way until 5 or something like that.
I think that's right. Yeah. So you know, okay, a little different crowd will be there probably, you know, the 3 o'clock Sunday crowd. The normal tea dance time, if I remember.
Yes, I was going to say. It's like, it's like a tea dance.
It is. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks so much again, Steve, for taking time out to chat.
Okay, thanks.
Yep. And there you heard it straight from the Steve's mouth. all about the Sonic City, Lion City rocks. Yeah, and he thinks that Singapore is such a Sonic City as well.
Yeah.
I always find it interesting, well, that you usually need someone from overseas to, you know, come down to appreciate what we have, right? Because down here, right, you know what it's like. I mean,
yeah, nobody really that's exactly what I was talking about with a good friend of ours, Don, who's doing music and step, you know, he's doing music now, he's doing stand up and poetry and stuff like that. And he was also talking about this. He was saying, like, you know, when's the next guy gonna come over here and then tell us what we need to do and what we should like. But it's just one of those things.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, go get the book, Sonic City, Making Rock Music and Urban Life in Singapore by Steve Fazeka. I hope I pronounced that name correctly.
Yes, you have.
Okay. You know, if you like this episode, please share it with your friends. And if you don't like this episode, just please share it with your friends as well. Annoy them. they'll be fun.
I need to insert some shameless self-promotion.
Yes.
So
yes.
I've been releasing kind of instrumental singles. I'm gonna do it every month. At Bandcamp only. I've given up on streaming at all, totally. So there's basically what has been out for a couple of weeks. Bella has been out, and the latest Bandcamp Friday, which has a new track called Gigi, right? So if you can check it out over at Bandcamp, kevinmatthews.bandcamp.com, that'd be great.
Yep. So go down to Bandcamp. We'll leave a link in the show notes for you guys to just get there. So. But Bandcamp is also where everything else is, right? KMAX stuff is all there.
Everything is there, yeah.
And everything is all in that Bandcamp page.
So yeah. I'm also putting out there 60% off for entire catalog.
Yeah, don't forget. Do we need a code? Is there a code or something like that we need to gain?
No. It's just available.
Okay. Cool. Anyway, yeah, so share this with your friends, leave a like, leave a subscribe, click the notification bell if there is one so that you'll know when the next episode drops. Again, for this year, Lion City Rock is going to be very gorilla, as in, like, not the big hairy animal. But, not the big hairy animal from Africa, but the other, with a U, gorilla with a U, gorilla with a U, as they said in the show. you know, thanks for all those guys for writing in the comments. We'll get to more of them in the future episodes as we go along. But until then, keep the Lion City rocking, and we'll see you next time. Ta-ta!
Ciao.